Good morning, you're very welcome to the show, and let's have a quick perusal of the headlines first. So the Sunday Times has an interview with Sean Quinn. I'd say the next thing you take out of it is he's not happy with the documentary. I think he's not happy because there were other people in it as well, and he said people talking about him he had never met some of those people. The Sunday World has the Father Oliver O'Reilly, the priest who was, of course, infamously referred to in said documentary as a backstabber, and he cailed at that house, and he is saying, "I did not stab Quinn." In back, there's an interview with him there in the Sunday World. The Father O'Reilly is also in the Irish Mail on Sunday, and he's talking about threats made against him. The Sunday Independent has a poll, and what they've picked out of that poll is that in that poll, the public believe gangland and provisionals linked. The Business Post: Microsoft plans private power plant on 900 million data centre sites. So this is not just a diesel generator or anything. They're building, it sounds like, a fairly fully fledged gas-fired power plant, and this is to run the data centres, but I think that is the law now, that you need to have sufficient backup power yourself to run your own data centre. They also have Intel offers workers thousands of euro to take extended leave, so you get a sign-up fee and you get up to 40% of your wages for if you took 3 months off. The Sun on Sunday this is all a bit weird. So the former state pathologist Mary Cassidy is going to be on Dancing with the Stars. I'm not going to read the headline actually. The Mirror: losing a child is the worst pain, and that is Hugh Harper, who is the father of Leona Harper, the 14-year-old and one of the people who died in Krishla. And I can imagine it is the worst pain anyone could imagine. Now, our panel this morning: Sinead O'Sullivan is a business economist. Craig Hughes is political correspondent with the Irish Daily Mail. Louise Bayliss is campaign coordinator for Focus Ireland and a founding member of Spark, which is single parents acting for the rights of kids. And Kate O'Connell is a pharmacist and a former Fine Gael TD. So a pharmacist, you can see where I got that from. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
I suppose we should start with the talking point of the week, Sean Quinn and that documentary. Louise, you picked out a piece by Ger Colleran in the Mail: Sean Quinn cries for himself, not the mess he left behind.
Yeah, I thought Ger Colleran's piece was very balanced, in that he recognised that the documentary it did show a very balanced approach. And I have to say, some parts of the documentary were eye-opening for me, in that I didn't, you know, I saw Sean Quinn as a villain, perhaps, because of the 2% levy on people's insurances. But I did see a different side in it. I saw the human man, and I saw, you know, that the disenfranchisement of people in Cavan and Fermanagh at the time, and the poverty, and how the good he brought to the area. And I suppose that part of the story was missing for me, so I appreciated seeing that there were other parts of the story.
You are the only person I know who would have been the top line you took from the documentary.
No, it wasn't the top line, but
okay.
I'm trying to.
I appreciate what you're doing here. Let's be fair.
I just thought that was something that was a new part to me that I hadn't really seen. And I was interested in that, and hearing the good comments, and, you know, because I suppose, and it did make me realise, you know, you do see one side of it, and I did appreciate that. Now, come to the end of the documentary and you see a man living in a very large, wealthy home and living there, complaining about only being given £500,000 consultancy and no power, and feeling self-pitying. And I think Ger Colleran's piece in the Irish Daily the Mail on Sunday really captured that really strongly, that, you know, that loneliness and lack of self-awareness, I think, is probably what we would have gotten from that, you know, there were so many people impacted. There are still so many people impacted on what happened back then, and not understanding the implications of some of his actions. Now, I did think, I appreciated that he did say during the documentary at some stage, I made this bet and it was on me and I take responsibility. Yeah. He did accept that, but then he didn't seem to accept that the consequences of that were you know, passed on to so many other people, and that he thought, well, I didn't think they could come after my assets because we'd already paid for them. Now, a man with such good business acumen, everybody knows, you know, if you're being declared bankrupt, everything is up for grabs. Yeah. So that was a piece that didn't sit comfortably.
But I mean, look, we have to take it in good
absolutely.
Faith on that. And, you know, I mean, it is interesting what you say, though. People are not one-dimensional, all good or all bad or whatever. People can
absolutely.
Do amazing things in their life. And so many businessmen have done extraordinary things all their lives and they do one thing.
Yeah.
And it does kind of change everything for
also,
them then.
And
it's the rest of the career.
And it also explains why people in Cavan are still so loyal to them. Even in some of the newspapers today, you could still see that loyalty there. Obviously, there's other issues going on, which I prefer not to discuss today. But, you know, there is that loyalty there and you wonder why. And it is because he did bring some good into the community.
Yeah. Craig.
I don't think we'll see Sean Quinn going into the realm of public affairs anyway, or PR. I think this is a drastic misstep on his part. He thought it would curry public favour. I think it did the complete opposite. You know, for someone who would frequented card tables, I mean, for him to think that he could make a bet and then not have to pay it back and leave the taxpayer on the line is contemptible. And I think the public
saw he was loaned money by Anglo-Irish Bank to underpin their share price, essentially. So, like, he wasn't alone in this, and, you know, you can understand how he might have misunderstood what was going on there.
Okay. But, I mean, when you talk about moving assets beyond the reach of the state to recoup losses, I mean, there's no excusing that.
Yeah, and he's not excusing it himself. He says, no, we shouldn't have done that. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I think, with reference to what you say, I mean, he was well able to take the gains, but not able to take the hits. So he seems to be well able to share the blame with Anglo when things went wrong, or with the wider system at the time. But when
I think it is actually accepted that the wider system was at
the
fault
wider,
here
yeah,
as well.
I understand that. But the higher you fly, the harder you'll fall. But I think in terms of what Louise said about that human element, I think we all obviously identify with the man of that age group, the businessman. I think we can all acknowledge and accept. But for me, that bit of humanity and that person I saw immediately was taken away with the lack of compassion and the commentary with regard to the violence that was meted out by whomever on the people that are directing the company now. And I found that very, very hard as a human to look at that response.
He had nothing to do with it. There's no suggestion he did.
I'm not saying he had or hadn't. I don't know who's involved. But what I do know is that any compassionate human should feel sympathy for a man that was branded, beaten, no matter who did
and
it.
He did say that you should never do that to another human being. But
to me,
I think it's
strong
what he
enough.
Went,
to me, it wasn't strong enough.
What he went on to say, probably for a lot of people, I think, sounded a bit sour.
Yeah, I don't think the response to that those terrible acts was sufficient, and I do think it diminished or got rid of any sort of love or humanity you'd have seen in him. You would have gone, well, actually, now that gets rid of that.
And I think what you're saying as well, Kate, is it wasn't just some random person. This was a colleague.
Somebody
and
knew.
It was. It seemed from watching the documentary that he had actually mentored Kevin Lunny up to a point.
Because we saw previously
him giving him an award.
And said that the most important thing about a person was the respect of their colleagues, and Kevin Lunny had that and everything.
Yeah, and he seemed to be really mentoring Kevin Lunny, and then to have turned so...
And also credited Kevin Lunny with the success of Quinn Direct
absolutely.
Yeah. How you could compartmentalise that as a human and separate that horrible activity, and you know, I just cannot.
Yeah.
That doesn't add up for me.
And again, what you're alluding to is that he did say you shouldn't do that to another human being, but went on to say people should ask Kevin Lunny why he was attacked, and he did say, I have nothing good
to me.
To
there's
say
a there's
about
a there's
Kevin
a bit
Lunny.
Not joined up there. I don't think that some of that doesn't make sense to me.
Sinead, you picked the editorial in the Sunday Times for Anna Gambler's tragic flaws, thinking he was a genius.
Yeah.
Why did you pick that?
Well, you know, I read this article, and honestly, you could have interchanged many names with the Quinn name, Musk, for example. And, you know, this really is the downfall for many people like Quinn. It is the fact that they think they're a genius after all. They surround themselves with sycophants. And, you know, it's just interesting because these people are not geniuses. They take bigger and bigger bets. They surround themselves with bigger and bigger institutions that allow them to take these bets. And, you know, what's really interesting about what Louise was saying, that kind of human element, we're all talking about Sean Quinn this week, but for me, the missing piece is, as Louise said, you know, she hadn't realized just how bad the economy was in Cavan and Fermanagh and how much he did for them. And, you know, that clearly states for me, like you see in the US a lot of the time, when you see these kind of genius industrialists building everything for everyone, there's a gap there that has been created by the government. And so the big question I had coming out of watching this documentary was, we're all looking at Sean Quinn, but what was the government doing that created this vacuum that allowed somebody to do this and to create such power within a community that resulted in, you know, whether it was violence, whether it was, you know, bankruptcies that disfavored their creditors. And so the question is, you know, where is the government in all of this? Why was there a vacuum there in the first place that enabled a single person to build the entire infrastructure in places like Fermanagh and Cavan, to which the people locally then owed their entire economic welfare?
Yeah, and I suppose, and Sean Quinn alluded to this himself, that you do get to a certain point in a business as well where decision making needs to be dispersed among a diversity of people and everything. And Sean Quinn, I think, saw as one of his own flaws, he had got to that size, but he was still the central kind of decision maker, clearly. And that's a problem in organisations, isn't it? That's why we have all that kind of company law around public limited companies and everything, isn't it? That there are checks and balances on decision making.
Well, checks and balances until you're too big. You know, if you look at, again, this article, you could have written it about Elon Musk. Where are the checks and balances on Elon Musk? Is Elon Musk too big to be regulated? Was Sean Quinn too big to be regulated? Where was the government in all of this? There was a vacuum. Why were the directors of these enterprises still able to be directors?
Oh, okay.
There was a complicity
We won't drag other directors into this because Sean Quinn is the person who is at issue here, and like other people may have made mistakes along the way, but they're not there.
I think, though, Brendan, you have to always question when someone becomes so big and they're allowed to plough a furrow where no one else ploughed a furrow before and somehow get to great heights. And I'm not suggesting anything, but how was this achieved? Like, maybe he is a genius. Maybe he is particularly brilliant. Or maybe it was just the circumstances of the time that fed into it. And maybe it was his GAA connections on the ground or his wider community connections that were referenced so much in the documentary. Maybe it is as simple as he is the Elon Musk of Ireland or the equivalent. Or what was the climate and the circumstances that allowed this business to flourish? And do we have to look into that? What were the circumstances that made a billionaire at the border? And when we looked at other companies that tried to maybe come in, compete in certain areas, there seems to have been barriers put in place. And a blind eye largely turned to that, and the company still... Quinn still continuing to build over time.
Yeah, so I mean, an element of sharp practice maybe, but nothing illegal was done in terms of another cement company trying to come in there or whatever.
Know.
There
what
were elements of
I'm
sharp practice,
is,
which Sean Quinn said himself.
What I'm questioning
Sean Quinn said himself, you know, these are the things you do and you wouldn't blame someone else for
so
doing it.
It's so much money, and to become a billionaire is just so much money. I think we have to look back forensically as to how an environment was created. And maybe it's all above board, and maybe it's all fine, and maybe it's all great. But to me, if it was that easy, everyone would have been at it.
Well, clearly they weren't. And Ian Keogh made an interesting point the other day that Sean Quinn is like one of those great old-fashioned industrialists, mm-hmm. like who dug it up out of the ground
when nobody else did, and created that situation.
And in a place, Craig, we know, which was said, where it's been said during the week, those people felt, on one hand, very far away from Belfast and ignored by that, and on the other hand, very far away from Dublin and ignored by them.
Yeah, and I think Ian Keogh made the point in the documentary that, you know, this was a region that was not served by the state, you know, and when Sean Quinn came in, very enterprising, built up. And I actually visited the glass paddle site on a school tour. I mean, he was held up as a beacon of light in Irish enterprise. And it wasn't. Exactly. Yeah. And I don't think, well, to my mind, I didn't see any questions around the enterprises he'd built in, that he'd built up from scratch.
It did subsequently emerge. There were huge questions over Quinn Direct, the insurance company, that was not being run.
Yeah, of course. And then we end up with the levy after that. But there was no doubt that you can see from the loyalty of people there that what it brought to a region where there simply wasn't employment before that.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, the other side of this, Kate and Louise, you both picked this. Louise, tell us about Father Oliver O'Reilly.
Yeah, there was an interview with Father Oliver O'Reilly, and anybody who saw the documentary would have seen that Sean Quinn's wife was very upset with Father O'Reilly because of his very strong stance on the pulpit. And we saw a clip of the pulpit where he called out the violence that was going on. He did not name names, but he called out the violence and said, as a community, we should reject that violence. And I think it was a very brave speech that he did on the pulpit. And then he said he was told by a source that there were cars going on fire and that he would need to be careful of his own car, that he was the next target. And he said he drew on his experiences as a missionary when he was in very hostile regions and in his own personal resources to get through that. And that was really good. And I connected with that story because I had an experience about 10 years ago, maybe 11 years ago now, where I was a whistleblower and I spoke up. And I know, you know, when you feel the need to say something and then you have that moment of, is this a right thing to do? Have I caused too much conflict for myself or my family? And I just, as a person to person, I listened to what he said in that article and just really connected with him and just think he was a very brave man to say what he did. And he seemed to be quite hurt, but he's not backing down. And that's a sign of a true, honest person. And you'd have to admire him for that, even if Sean Quinn's wife doesn't like the tone he spoke it.
Yeah. And again, there is no connection. What he said from the order and Sean Quinn.
He didn't make any connection. He was himself, very strong. But he wanted the community to stop the violence, and he did not name anybody or blame anybody.
No, but it was Patricia Quinn did say that she felt it was backstabbing.
Well, he'd got tea and wine, hadn't he, in the house?
He had Kayleigh in that house. And Kayleigh, we saw in the first part of the documentary, up in that part of the country, does not mean they were all madly Irish dancing around the house. It seems to be that
a party.
People come and play cards and that kind of thing.
Rambling in sort of style behaviour. Yeah. But he seems... The priest seems to have taken on the role of community leader and was able to stand up. But also, I just think it's very interesting that somehow getting tea and wine in someone's house would just, you know, keep you quiet.
And I think somebody did need to call out, because nobody's implying anybody is, you know, one specific person is responsible for it. But the community did react badly. I mean, they talked about lagging concrete.
Parts of the community.
Parts of the community,
badly.
Obviously, not all of the community. But there were things going on that were not fair. I mean, the lagging person who was coming in, and he was threatened on the day of his wife's death. I mean, that just was an appalling thing, too. And you hear that thing. So I think the priest was right to take a moral stand. Be a moral leader in the community, in a community that respected priests. And I think he was very brave and he felt threatened, but he's sticking to it. So I think that's... But it was nice to see that personal experience.
It goes
experience.
To show the important role, though, of priests and people like that in the community still.
Isn't it funny how, and, you know, we mentioned Chrysler there from the front of the papers. Isn't it funny how often priests, in even recently... Do we still turn to them in this country?
I mean, the priest up in Crease, I can't remember his name, and how could I not remember it? After, but I mean, he really led Ireland throughout that period of time.
Will we move on to the slightly safer ground of politics, Craig? Who thought politics would be the light relief? So, Craig, will you just give us the there's a poll in the Sunday Independent, an Ireland Thinks poll conducted last Thursday and Friday, sample size 1,352 people. The margin of error is plus or minus 2.7%. What does it tell us about the state of the parties?
So Sinn Féin remain the most popular party in the country on 34%. That's no change from the last poll. Fine Gael have gained some ground, up 2 points to 23%. Fianna Fáil, no change on 17%. And then down the smaller parties, Sock Dems up 1 to 5%. Aintu 4%, no change. Labour 3%, no change. Solidarity down 2 points, 3%. Green Party, no change on 3%. And Independence and Others down 1 to 9%. I think what's interesting on this is that Sinn Féin seem to have cemented their place there around that 34%. Despite what has been a very difficult month for them.
They were off in another poll during the week or in the Sunday Times last week?
Down slightly, but still maintaining quite a dominant lead. And I think given that this has been the most turbulent time for them in opposition, to still have that gap between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, I think they'll be quite comfortable with that. Yeah. I think the interesting thing from this poll for me is that, you know, Fianna Fáil no change at 17%, yet at the same time, the majority of voters would rather Micheál Martin, the Fianna Fáil leader, to stay on as Taoiseach ahead of Leo Varadkar. So I guess what frustrates some people in Fianna Fáil is that, you know, given the popularity of Micheál Martin, why aren't they getting the boost on the back of that?
Yeah, why are they not?
I think it's difficult. I think when you look at what people like in Micheál Martin, it's been his diplomacy on the international stage. It isn't really things that have seeped down into grassroots level. His critics within the party would say that he hasn't done enough for the party in terms of going around the country and doing party events. And I guess it'll be interesting to see now whether he takes the Ministry for Foreign Affairs after the changeover. This is where the big question mark is. While people think he'd be suited for that role, it depends on whether he wants to stay on as leader, because the other assertion is that if he takes that role, the people who are conspiring against him in the party will have more kind of free space.
He'll be out of the country.
Exactly.
Kate, Eoin O'Malley is suggesting that in his piece that the reason that Micheál Martin is maybe more popular to stay on as Taoiseach is because he is kind of a less Marmite-y person maybe than Leo Varadkar, that he hasn't offended anyone, he's inoffensive.
It could be that, or it could be many reasons for that, but the agreement is there and the deal is done that there is going to be a swap in December. I'd say it's a fair enough bet, maybe, if you were betting to say Micheál Martin. If I was putting money on this week on a reshuffled position, I'd say Foreign Affairs, with the shared island department that Taoiseach set up, Micheál Martin set up, moving in with him. Obviously occupying the space that Sláinte Seachéir used to occupy before it was put in the shredder. I'd imagine he'll take up the foreign affairs role. But it will be an interesting, it's a couple of weeks now, isn't it, until the reshuffle. And we'll see the
2 weeks,
we've already seen it, you know, a little bit of noise being created by certain ministers sort of vying for position. But according to the papers, they will be very conservative changes at the top. But it will be interesting, I think, to see. You know, obviously the big jobs have already been decided. Once the big lads are sorted, we're grand. Once the holy trinity of Simon, Leo and Pascal, or the holy trinity of Eamon, Leo and Micheál, or whatever trio of gentlemen, three wise men in Irish politics, once they're sorted first, and then the rest of the people get sorted. And once we maintain the gender quota at not too offensive a level, so you can't really bump off any women, but there doesn't really have to be much net gain in women because there isn't enough women to promote, obviously, in Irish politics.
But there is an issue for them, I think, in the reshuffle, because so the three parties have three super junior ministries, and Fine Gael are going to have the chief whip's role. So Hildegard Nocton currently has the Fine Gael super junior position. So if she doesn't become the chief whip, then she'd have to be bumped out of cabinet, which again wouldn't look great for the government on the issue of gender.
It's a very difficult conundrum. But I mean, that, you know, why, I think, and I mean, obviously there's a good dose of sarcasm in what I'm saying. I mean, why are the top jobs? Why is Hildegard Nocton not being considered for finance or public expenditure? Yeah. Why is Heather Humphreys not being considered?
Helen McEntee
as well. I mean, she's obviously
on maternity. She's in a very, very senior position.
She's a couple of cabinet positions and a super junior behind her. So, you know, it's a constant narrative you see in Irish politics over the last number of years, where I remember Helen, when I was in the Dáil, I think it was the junior ministry image, and Helen was used in every picture to kind of, you know, she was one of the scenes, she was in the senior picture and the junior picture. So trying to you know, I've often joked, once you have a female usher in the background, it nearly counts as a woman in the picture. So we're ending up with, you know, a Taoiseach, a male Taoiseach, males in Minister for Finance, and the jobs divided up between the lads, and essentially, to my mind, the women not really been considered for the higher positions in the Irish government.
Okay, so look, we take it that is your position on it.
Why not Hildegard Nocton or Heather Humphreys for Finance, or... Tánaiste is divided, but, you know, any of the other health or, and Norma Foley has
we don't know yet what they will do. And look, there are a lot more women in senior positions than there were a few years ago, and change does not happen overnight. You would definitely have to say. Okay, now there's another thing coming out of this poll, Sinead, that you picked is Kevin Cunningham of Ireland thinks, and he has highlighted the thorny matter of immigration, and the rise in people pick the two issues they think are most important, and immigration has risen substantially in the last few polls as an issue of importance to people.
Yeah, I thought this was really interesting. I love Kevin Cunningham's work. I love the statistics that he provides for all of his articles. And here he says that this month, 11% believe it to be a top issue, that is, of immigration, up from 7% last month and 5% in October. So obviously this is very relevant given what we're seeing in Dublin at the minute with immigrants. And it's interesting because we have this kind of, you know, and as he points out in his article, we have this fear or potentially even becoming a reality of driving up support for far-right political parties in Ireland. Why I think this is really interesting to have this published on Sunday is because last week we had published that Ireland actually has the fastest ageing population in the EU. And a lot of people may not kind of link those two things. But what this basically tells me about the economy is that if we have Ireland's fastest ageing population in the EU, we have one of the biggest needs in the EU for an inwards immigration movement. Yeah. And so where we kind of see this movement towards far-right policy and politics is directly at odds with what our economy needs to flourish. And it's going to be really interesting to see how that plays out over the coming weeks and months, especially as we go through some political turmoil, as we change parties, as we start thinking about United Ireland, as we start thinking about cost of living and economic crises.
Yeah, OK. So in theory, and Germany pretty much did this, opened the doors because they wanted younger people to come into the economy. And in theory, that's very good. But I suppose the issue at the moment is that there is a perception that there's nowhere for these people to live. And then a lot of them don't seem to be able to work for various reasons. Craig, you wanted to come in there?
Yeah, and I think there's a piece in the Mail on Sunday today by John Drennan, which kind of highlights the concern among ministers about that, you know, they're failing to adequately deal with the situation gives rise to far-right ideologies here, and they're kind of preying on that. But the difficulty that's happening is, you know, all the local TDs will say, we want engagement before people are put into the community. But like the counterpoint to that is, and the Secretary General of the Department of Children has said this, there often isn't time. And if it's a difference between making someone be homeless for a week or putting them in a community, I think it's pretty obvious what you have to do there. So while it is difficult, that's the bind they seem to be caught in.
Yeah. And I think some people have suggested, though, that there is a halfway house there, which is that you might not have time to consult with the community. And indeed, I think Leo Varadkar said, no, there will not be consultation back and forth, but that information should be given, and that in the vacuum of that information, this is where other misinformation and other things can seep into it. Louise,
you also picked
that John Drennan piece in the Mail.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. And I totally agree with what you're just saying there. It's the lack of communication, because in Focus Ireland, Focus Housing Association will do developments, and we have come across similar issues where we're doing a big development and the local community will say we do not want it here. So we've known that and we now react it. And obviously this is an emergency situation.
So what do you do then in that situation? How do you deal with it?
We will literally...
No, you have the luxury of time, obviously.
Obviously, we have the luxury of time. But I think the key thing is communications. So we will immediately let all the local councillors in the area know this is what's planning. We will then write out to all the residents in the area and explain that we are planning to do this. We'll then call a local local meeting and explain and address any concerns the locality may have. They, because there would be prejudice that we may be moving in people with addiction issues or mental health issues. So we try, you know, or that it will be ghettoised. So we try to explain their concerns and, you know, communicate that these will be supported. There won't be antisocial behaviour in as much as we can control, and that these are people who are impacted by the housing crisis. So once
does it make a difference?
It does. We just last month we got we were concerned. We were putting in a new development in Cabra. We were gifted a piece of land by one of the nuns, one of the convents, and we got gifted a piece of land, and we just got permission last month for 95 unit development in Cabra, which is going to be brilliant, and we're really all excited about it. But there was a lot of work done to that, and the planning permission was granted, and there were no objections, which again was due to the work in the community. Now, I totally take Craig's point is that you don't have that luxury of time. However, there is luxury in time when, you know, one of the stories in one of the comments in John Drennan's piece was that the community only found out 600. Well, they were told 600 immigrants were coming in, and they were all going to be single men, and because somebody was working on the building. Now, before somebody started working on the building, people had to be recruited to work in the building. Plans had to be drawn up. At that stage, it would have been easier to go directly to the community. Once you're doing the building work, you have time to talk to people. You've time to write a letter, and you stop that. And I just going back to Sinead's point about that vacuum in Cavan, where Sean Quinn was able to build his thing because people were disenfranchised. That's what you want to stop now. We can see these patterns, and we could stop that now by giving the correct information and making sure people are part of the community.
Okay. Kate, we want to be very careful here to say that all those people who are concerned about immigration in that poll, all those people who are concerned in communities are not far right, racist, whatever else, but that there can be an imposition then by these. It seems to be travelling bands of various activists and stuff can involve themselves.
Most people have many concerns. Yeah. You know, it doesn't make them particularly nasty people. I agree with you on that.
Yeah. But as a politics watcher, the point has been made a lot in the last couple of weeks that we are now one of the few countries around without a far right political party. Do you think that and the point has been made as well that a lot of local politicians in these areas are seen to have very little patience in their comments with people's concerns, and maybe people are not feeling listened to. If they are not listened to by the established parties, would you be concerned about the rise of some kind of a far-right party here?
Well, I suppose with the way the proportional representation works, there's always been, we've seen this with other issues in the past, where there's always been scope there for a single issue candidate to pull through. We have that in many constituencies where we've independents that have got through on single or two issues and have maintained their seats over the years. So there is the political and the way votes are divided in Ireland is there for that to happen 100%, and there's already that happening. But I do think in terms of people coming in from be Ukraine or any other country, we have to look at it. We've had direct provision. Direct provision happened in my professional career. Lissy Woolen in Athlone, the direct provision centre, started when I started my first job as a pharmacist, which is about 20 years ago, I'd say now. And then we had Mosny. And I think we're all very ashamed of putting people into those environments. And I think we don't need to do any research on the negative impacts that had on families. And that really you had to be very determined to get yourself out of one of those places and manage to get into a university place if you were child born in that. So I do think we have to look at this in terms of, have we City West as essentially a glorified direct provision centre? And are we going to create...
City West is a transitory
it
point
is,
at
yeah,
the moment.
Yeah, and like I
it,
employ...
It, you know, they people have to be
I employ a couple of people who
somewhere.
Work there. I'm very familiar with the setup, and people are very happy there at the minute. But
and
in terms
not there
of
for a long period of time,
some people have been. I don't want to get into people's part, but some people have been there for a while. But they're very happy, and there's no issues. I'm not hearing any complaints. But in terms of creating a new life for people, and as Louise referred to, or I think it was yourself, sorry, referred to, the ageing population and our pensions deficit, and we don't have enough kids and we don't have enough workers. We do need people like the Germans needed them from other countries. But I do think we have to look at resettlement, enabling people to have their life here, enabling people to navigate the system. And I often think, if I was landed over in Mariupol with three children, how would I get around the system?
Now, are people not, with the system as it is, are people not very much given their PPS numbers
they
and processed and told how to access
but
whatever they need?
It's still very daunting, and there is a huge language barrier there.
And what could we do?
I do think that we need to hold people's hands a little bit more and to say, well, you know, it was said to me recently, you know, there isn't much difference between working and the dole. And to explain that the difference is that, you know, in time you learn more money. To try and help them navigate this, not be caught in a poverty trap. Because in my experience, and I don't mean to generalise, everybody I have met, now I am an employer, is looking to work and wants to contribute and is grateful to what Ireland is doing. And I think we need to reciprocate that with a little bit of hand-holding.
Yeah. Because I suppose at the moment it's community groups and kind of civil society.
Yeah, but I think individual business as well. I think a mentorship programme.
Okay.
I think, you know, enabling people like, you know, obviously if someone's a pharmacist or a dentist, it's easier. But somebody who maybe worked in retail.
Are you doing this?
I don't want to get into people's personal business. Okay. I have two people employed from Ukraine, and one of them is in a mentorship program to try and enable that person as best we can to have their own life in Ireland without me or the government or anyone else assisting in time.
Okay.
I think business, there's scope there for business to mentor, not just a tokenistic cleaner job or whatever, a real path to, if you're a chartered accountant in Ukraine, to somehow becoming one in Ireland. And if that path takes 5 years, fine. But the language barrier is a real problem. Where I've employed people from Poland and Romania in the past, they've had a little bit of English.
Okay.
But there seems to be, you know, zero English, and you're starting at ground zero. And it's very challenging for children in schools as well.
Yeah, that's
and being moved around.
That's very interesting. Sinead, do you want to come back in there?
Yeah, so just getting back to the issue of immigration and kind of far-right political movements. I totally understand what you're saying, Kate, and I fully 100% agree. But is the issue here not, you know, trying to take a balanced view of why we're seeing some of these shifts? Is the issue not that people genuinely believe, and, you know, it is the fact that the economy is full of scarcity in its resources? And so if we say that the issue, you know, or the solution to creating this kind of immigration-friendly place is to give more resources when it is the resources that people are scared of giving to immigrants in the first place, that's not necessarily going to resolve the problem of people.
Is Kate not suggesting the opposite, though? Is she not suggesting that we don't, that they not be reliant on handouts and on charity and all those things that are not good for people, and that they would be, that they, we allow them a bit of self-determination and we allow them to make a contribution? And God forbid that some of them might be builders.
Yes, on the one hand, I think she is saying that. But then I also hear things like hand-holding and more education. Now, I don't personally believe this, but I think that a lot of the people that we're talking about that are moving into far-right ideologies will hear things like hand-holding and increased education and increased support and immediately think, what about me? What about my community? And where is... It's my children that will pay for this.
But if what you fear is unrest, surely by turfing a load of people into the likes of Lissy Woolen and Athlone is going to actually foster that which people are afraid of, the far right protesters are afraid of.
Yes,
surely if you just, you know, go, you just stay in that sort of chicken battery place for 3 years, of course that's going to foster anger and resentment and create problems in society.
No, I think you're totally right there, Kate, but I think there is another element which Sinead is saying as well, is that there is a dearth of resources in the country. You know, anybody trying to access a GP at the moment, anybody trying to access housing, I think Ireland is a great country to live in if you're healthy and you own your own house or you have that security. But there are so many people who are on the margins. Like, we know that there's 11,397 people registered as homeless last month. That's a massive thing. And those people are scared. And, you know, there's an awful lot of people scared because there is a housing crisis and yeah, there's no, a shortage.
And Ukrainians who come here have no access to the homelessness services.
There's a completely different system. They're on the IPAS system, and people who are on the emergency list are on the housing services list, and in two different departments. And I'm not for one second trying to pit two things, but I'm trying to acknowledge what Sinead is saying, that there is fear, genuine fear there with people, you know, that there is an overwhelming GP. I mean, I tried to get access to the GP a couple of weeks ago. My daughter was sick and I was told it was 5 days to get her an appointment into the GP. And there is this fear that we do not have the services. But the answer isn't to ignore people who feel marginalised. The answer is to say, let's work with you. Let's create better GPs. And as you said, you alluded to it there where you said maybe some of those Ukrainians are builders. Maybe they are, and let's use them and let's build homes.
Okay,
everybody
Craig.
Included.
I think housing is going to be key here, because while they're not at odds at the moment and they're being given temporary accommodation, I think the thinking is getting towards that in the medium to long term, the government is going to have to find permanent housing solutions for Ukrainians who want to stay here. And at the moment, we're struggling to meet our already modest and our modest housing targets. I mean, it looks like we're not going to meet them for 24, 25. So, the Housing for All plan we revealed in the mail last month, the targets are actually are drastically under what's needed to meet existing demand based on population growth.
Yeah, but they do now include the Ukrainians who have come here. As far as I know, since October, the government have now included. I heard them actually ring in with a correction to a radio programme the other day.
On the Housing for All targets, the Housing for All targets haven't been changed since they were published last year. They will be updated, we're told, in the new year. They haven't been.
Okay, well, I'm sure we will get clarity on that very quickly if they'll be on to us. Sinead, I'll give you one last word on this.
Yeah, and so like to Kate's point, you know, Kate makes a very sound economic point, and that, you know, that's the thinking that I would also use and say that, you know, these people are good and we should have them here and our economy needs them. Again, far right political parties are driven not by economic thinking, but ideology. And so maybe the vacuum that we have here is not that, you know, we're not consulting the communities before they arrive, but that maybe on a more macro level, we haven't decided as a population what we want Ireland and what we want the future of this island to be.
Yes.
Nail on head.
Yeah. And so maybe that is where we are not seeing eye to eye. And maybe that is the vacuum in which this far right political ideology is being driven.
Kate O'Connell, text for you there. Norma Foley's in a senior position, as is Mary Butler, education.
No, Mary's not senior. Mary's junior.
Yeah, but let me finish the text. Education and mental health are important areas to some of us, Kate O'Connell, that texter says, right?
They are.
They might not feel senior to you, but they're important. And just another.
I don't think I said there was no female. I'm very much aware that Norma is, and mental health is very important. But Mary Butler is a junior minister, as is Anne Rabbitt.
In very important areas.
In very important areas, but still not in cabinet.
People might like to know that Fáilte Isteach volunteers throughout the country offer conversation practice and a local welcome to anyone coming to Ireland who doesn't have English as a first language. That's from Newland County Meath, okay? So Fáilte Isteach. That's good to know. Now, Louise Bayliss, there's a piece in the Sunday Times about Dublin after dark. Creeps, scams, spiked drinks and fights, by Patrick O'Donoghue.
Yeah, it's it really struck a chord with me, because I was out myself on Friday night, and I've realised I've changed my practice of going out because I go out earlier and come back early. Now, that could be a thing about my age, let's be honest, but I think it's more to do with I do not like getting the bus home on my own, and I used to get the bus home and I wouldn't have thought twice about it. But like last summer, a friend of mine was visiting me and she was walking literally down out of the side gate in my estate and was attacked no more than 50 metres from my house. So even at that, it makes you more cautious about travelling around as a woman on your own in Dublin. And then there's also the shortage of taxis at the moment. Yeah. So I realise I'm going out at 7 and making sure I get a taxi before everybody else comes out. So, and then I'm talking to some of my friends who have teenage daughters and who are now starting to go out socialising as well. And some of their reports has been absolutely shocking to me, that they wear denim jackets because they're so afraid of being injected. Apparently that's a thing that's going on, that they're being shot in the arms instead of, like, you know, you protect protect your drinks from date raping, but now you're wearing denim jackets so you don't get a shot on an injection at you.
Yeah.
And hearing these stories, it's intimidating. It's not what you would want for Dublin.
Yeah, I think a lot of us who are maybe that little bit older, possibly the pandemic hastened our kind of return to the suburbs a bit, and then you go back into town and you think, okay, is it me or has this kind of changed here? Cray, you're a bit younger, you're out and about. Has town become a more forbidding place, or have I become an older man, or what do you reckon?
I don't know. Thankfully, I live close enough to town, so I'm not relying on public transport getting out, cycling out. It's fine. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. It still seems similar to me now.
Grand. Okay.
No adverse things to report at the moment.
I don't know. I was out at Whelan's in a gig on Thursday night, and
Don't say anything about not feeling good in Whelan's on Thursday.
No. Whelan's was great. Whelan's was great.
So take it out of Whelan's.
On the street. I don't know what that street's called. Which is why I'm.
Is that Wexford Street?
Yeah. I could not get over how disgust, like, I was walking, and it was probably only 11 o'clock at night, walking through chip boxes, vodka bottles, like it was unavoidable. I've never seen Dublin look, and I have a friend actually visiting from the US this weekend, and I'm embarrassed nearly to take him into town. I was mortified at the antisocial behaviour, and I just could not get over.
When you say antisocial behaviour, what kind of stuff?
Like, okay, well, I mean, you know, maybe it's not drug dealers or violent crimes.
Messy, yeah.
Like, just hundreds of people who couldn't walk, who were like falling over themselves on the ground. I was just really shocked in the middle of this litter. And I didn't grow up in Dublin. I've never spent years of my life living here before now, so I was never younger enjoying it here. But I was really disappointed. I felt embarrassed, and I wouldn't want a friend tourist to have seen that.
Yeah. Kate, do you go into town anymore?
No.
No.
I don't know. I mean, I suppose I think I'd be a car to bar sort of person, in that if I was going out with my friends, my husband doesn't drink, so he's kind of my own taxi driver, which is kind of handy.
For God's sake, yeah.
But I don't think I'd venture out on a night now. And I genuinely would have been up to the pandemic, a nightclub goer. I wouldn't head out into town and randomly walk out on the street now to get a taxi.
So surgical strike kind
of
thing.
I'd be like, would you mind now dropping in for me later on?
Listen, also in the Sunday Times, Kate, the surgeries in Turkey, clinic lined up butt lift within hours of arriving in Turkey, is Julianne Carr's headline. And it's a very telling piece, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, this idea that surgery is fine and there's no risks attached and it's grand to go over in an airplane and half an hour consultation in and have a general anaesthetic. Again, I mean, if that was safe, we'd be doing it that way here. And I think we need to have a public health message, a very strong public health message, that Turkey isn't under the EU health regulations. You're operating in a different jurisdiction. Also, that it would never be recommended, if you had an operation of any sort, cosmetic or other, in Ireland, that you would get in an aeroplane the next day in terms of post-operative clots. And it's a huge challenge for our health service. And I think it was Dr. Donal O'Shea was on the radio in the last couple of weeks on RT discussing what they're landed with in Ireland. So when people don't actually die, but when they come home and there's a secondary issue emerges, they have no access to medical records. They don't know what procedures or pathways were used because they're operating outside of the normal procedures.
Are you seeing it? Like
we'd hear the conversations when people post up, when they've been admitted to an Irish hospital, fixed up and hopefully survive and get prescribed antibiotics. But what we do see a good bit of, and it's everywhere, is The use of cosmetic fillers, Botox, so not general anaesthetic stuff, but fillers, things that, that can be given by injection, being administered by the wrong people. So they're only supposed to be administered by a dentist or a doctor. So being administered by beauticians, the use of abrasive...
Are they not allowed? They're not allowed,
no? There's certain people under the supervision, but there's a lot of online purchasing of fillers. And I did have a case... of a person who had a reaction to a filler where they did an autoimmune response and they had to have solvent incrementally injected into their face to, like acetone essentially, in microns in to dissolve the glue in their face. And this was a young woman. So without, I mean, it's very serious, but it's been given a sort of a smell of this is all grand. It's like putting on a moisturiser.
Kind of the norm, like maybe it's again, it's an age thing,
yeah, it's
but I'm looking around
thing.
That it used to be kind of unusual, but now you have half take for granted that a lot of people I know or a lot of people I rub up against and see all seem to have subtle little bits and pieces.
Bits and bobs.
Yeah.
And bits and bobs are grand, but there, I suppose there is a long way between a bit of filler being put into your upper lip and having your backside moved halfway up your body or whatever. I don't know, whatever happens.
No, it should be said, it is made clear in that piece that you cannot get a Brazilian butt lift in Ireland. There's one available in Turkey, which you can't get it here. Did you want to come in there, Sinead? Something you'd like to tell us?
Well, on the subject of Brazilian butt lifts. No, so earlier this week, I actually went to visit one of Ireland's startup, Sisu. They're kind of an aesthetics clinic. And they've recently scaled.
And we are not in any way linking him with any kind of unqualified people doing botched
lip jobs.
Whether
he's had Brazilians or but I bring it up because I was talking to. So they're doctor led, and the problem that they're solving for, which I think is in Ireland actually a really big problem, is this kind of, as Kate says, this kind of unregulated back alley type Botox filler. And the doctor there really was telling me about some of the horror stories he's seen. People buying this stuff online themselves, injecting it into their own faces in the mirror, making themselves go blind. So it doesn't necessarily to be the Brazilian butt lift. It could just be something as simple as a filler that is actually... Yeah, it's impacting a lot of people in Ireland.
And it's no different than buying illegal drugs. It's not regulated, so it's a huge issue.
Okay, and on that Brazilian butt lift bombshell, we will leave it. The detective here says, as a non-drinking person, what did Brendan mean by "for God's sake" about the husband who doesn't drink? I mean, for God's sake, isn't that great? Jeez, you want to watch every word, every intonation.
We need the Attorney General here on a Sunday morning,
yeah,
Brendan.
I meant, for God's sake, a typical Kate O'Connell, marry a fellow who drives around the place. I wouldn't suspect her of
anything.
What do
you mean
less.
By that?
Exactly. You can take it though. Sinead O'Sullivan, Craig Hughes, Louise Bayliss and Kate O'Connell, thank you all very much, and we're going to take a break.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.